Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Dr. Philip Miles, a senior lecturer in sociology and English literature at the University of Bedfordshire. Am I right so far?
You are indeed.
You are a cultural sociologist, which is, wish I was one of them, with a specific interest in the sociology of literature, the study of creativity, ethnographic methods, and the sociological and literary theory. Have I got everything there?
That's right. You have? Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful, but yeah, I guess I have an interest in all of those.
Hey, things. It's a hell of a portfolio, never mind a mouthful. But the bit I want to focus on before we get into it, because I've invited Philip on to talk about three films that have impacted everything in your adult life, and he's given me three titles, and we'll get onto that after this preamble chat. I wanted to focus on the study of creativity, brackets, processes, and spaces, because what I should let people in on is a little light onto dark is that you and I used to work at the same part of the civil service in years gone by. So that's how we know each other. We've both gone very different paths in terms of social housing. And one of the things that I've done since leaving that work is become a writer. As well as podcasting and stuff. And one of the things that I had to learn was how to be creative, because I was a journalist and I was a communications professional and that kind of stuff. So writing words was never hard. But when you get to write things, which is, can you just do a summary of this policy? Can you give us the news as far as what the organization's doing? You know, everyone's giving you what they want, and then you just make it into a new form. Whereas I'd never worked with a blank bit of paper before, like where nobody's asking you to do it. Nobody wants what you're going to do. And nobody gives a shit. And like, that's
same in academia.
Well, in the same sense, then you kid yourself on. You go, well, geez, you know, you start playing games and you start inventing things. You go, hold on a minute, I've got something here. And then you start to grow it. Now, what I didn't know going into that was the relentlessness of never being told what to do. And that sounds weird from a work point of view, because obviously one of the biggest gripes I've ever had about work is, you know, to the point of like, I've got to do it, because if I don't do it, they'll get cheesed off and I won't get paid, I'll get fired and stuff. But when it's just down to you and only you, it's a really weird thing. Now, I read a couple of books that really helped me. One was called Art and Fear, written by two art lecturers. They talked a lot about the compulsion in terms of creativity. And in fact, they even said that they prefer the word work to creativity in a way.
Oh yeah.
They always saw artistic pursuits as being a work in progress on a work in progress, i.e. we're always learning. We never stop. It's like the idea of, if I'm trying to say I want to be as good as Quentin Tarantino, that's like a nonsense idea. Whereas what I can do for sure is be better than I was 12 months ago. If I write, by definition, I'll have improved the writing. And the other guy was Stephen Pressfield, written a book called War on Art. And again, and he's a guy that came from screenwriting, so I could directly relate to what he was saying. And But again, his was just about relentlessness, about consistency, about persistence, about patience. None of these things are skills that people teach you in creative writing, but they are the things that you need around the right, the process of trying to create something that nobody gives a damn whether you do or you don't.
The thing is, when you started, you said about process and method and stuff like that. I mean, remind me of the line. Remind me of that word, the line, or those words, the line, and I'll come back to it in a minute. But I started to look at this because basically I was looking for a big project.
Yeah.
And I'd always been, I was, in my mid-40s, early mid-40s at the time. And I'd always been interested in why people carry on being creative long after. I think I've used this expression to death, but I'll use it again for the sake of our discussion.
Yeah.
A rock band who, are playing live to 30 people, once in a while, sometimes more than that, but you know what I mean. And long, long gone has been the, the possibility of a major record contract and touring the USA and smashing up the Holiday Inn in Seattle or something. And I became very interested in why they carried on doing this. Why do people carry on being creative into their 40s, 50s, 60s, sometimes when there is no hope, like you mentioned earlier on, not no hope, but little hope of worldwide superstardom, right?
The profit motive has gone completely.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a way of putting it. Thanks, Stu. That's a way of putting it. Yeah. And so I was kind of interested in what kind of inspires them, what keeps them going. That doesn't mean to say that what I eventually ended up doing was working with people who had kind of given up hope and were just being, playing guitars or writing books for nothing. But basically, that was the initial sort of spark. Why do people keep doing it? And what does it feel like to be creative in your 40s and stuff like that? Because I went on Radio Scotland a while ago to explain, I was saying at the time, if you think about it, creativity, especially in the music industry, is often associated with kind of breakthrough stuff when you're in your early 20s. You're kind of past it. There's a band I'm really into at the moment from Canada called Always, and their lead singer is about 32 or something. I may be wrong, but I'm sure she's around about 30. And I was thinking to myself, it's kind of like the first I've heard of them, and she's not middle-aged, but you'd think that because I suddenly appeared on the scene, or certainly appeared on my radar, she's going to be like 21 or something. So it's that sort of thing going on in the background. Anyway, to get to the point, I started talking to a rock band up in the Midlands who were amazingly welcoming and very interesting to talk to. And, they were dead serious about what they were doing. They were all experienced musicians. They'd been around the block a few times. They were just making music, releasing it, playing gigs and enjoying themselves. And so I spoke to them about why they did it. And what happened as a result of this, the project kind of mushroomed from that point where they started to explain this kind of place that they went to when they were creating music. And any musician listening will know, quite often it's in a jam situation, where you start to sort of like jam tracks together and you start writing in that way. And they wrote as a group. And so I started talking to them in more depth about this, and they started explaining this almost like, now forgive me for what sounds a little bit silly here, but this almost like trance-like state they go into where they kind of like don't know where they're going. And when they come out the other end of it, they're not sure how they'd been there, right? So I flew with this idea, and it went back to, it sort of started to remind me of this theoretical standpoint that I use. I promise I won't bang on and on and on about this, but I'll explain it to people who are listening. Yeah, I'll explain what I kind of mean. Years ago when I wrote a PhD thesis, I used this this theory that I called the mezzanine, the sort of in-between state. But what I used it as, the reason I used the word mezzanine instead of liminality or something like that, was I sort of felt that this kind of notion of being in the room but not of the room, so it's kind of there but not there. Oh. It's kind of part of the setup but not part of the setup, right? That sort of thing. Instead of it being sort of separated by space. And the thing was, I sort of realized that what they were actually explaining was a kind of psychological mezzanine, this sort of thing about, that sort of feeling when you're driving down the motorway and you think, where on earth did the last 20 miles go? Yes. I don't remember it. I know I've been conscious and I know I haven't driven into the back of a lorry or anything. Thank God, I'm safe and well, but I can't remember going past, Sandbach services, right? That sort of thing. And so anyway, it's that sort of feeling. So I sort of likened this sort of idea to also, I then started to explain it in ways where they were explaining their songwriting and, you know, that Syd Barrett, Peter Green sort of notion of everything is a cover version. The original only exists in time, you know, that nothing, every time you play a record, you're playing a copy of it. Every time you play something live, you're playing a cover version, even if it's a cover version of your own song, and so on and so forth. And I started to expand it into that sort of idea. Anyway, to get to the point, I started moving it out into artists, fine artists, potters, writers, you know, sort of fiction writers and so on and so forth, photographers, etc. And to my surprise, they all started explaining the same thing. And it was this liminal in-between space. Now, what this moved on to, and I'm nearly there, is this artist down on the South Coast. It all became a book called Midlife Creativity and Identity, available from Emerald Publishers.
Ooh, we'll put a link in the show.
Basically, from all good bookshops. It was published a couple of years ago. Anyway, this guy who spoke to me was a fine artist. He'd invented himself as a fine artist. And while we were in his studio, very nice place actually, that he got set up on the South Coast, he started to sort of explain this to me. And he said, right, the line, right? He said, let me show you what I mean. I said, sure, go ahead, right? And so he produced this piece of, like, you know, paper or whatever, piece of charcoal. And he said, watch. He said, like, I'm going to start drawing on this page. And he said, I don't know where this is going. He said, the line's going to begin. And I can't explain to you. I have no control over what's going to happen next, right? And I sort of said to him, but surely, you know, you must have an idea in your head. He said, well, yeah, I've got some ideas. But he said, but I've got kind of, there is an in-between state between the idea and the kind of production of whatever it is that comes out the other end. Mm. And I started thinking, that's really, really interesting. That's a kind of psychological mezzanine. It's like, in some ways, what the musicians are, I'm calling aura with the musicians. They're almost like the Walter Benjamin sort of vibe about, you know, the aura of something, the kind of sense that it cannot be really repeated. And he was explaining it in many ways, that you never have full control over what's happening. Now, in terms of writing, I creatively write as well as academically write. Mm. You're well more advanced than I am on this. You know, you do your script writers. If I spoke to script writers about this as well, and the process tends to be not haphazard, but it's this notion of you sit down and you start to write and you kind of see where it goes. You've got this rough idea, but you cannot ever foresee what is going to come out at the end of the trance when you stop, right? Yeah. So that's how I set it up. And it's very similar. Recent stuff I've been writing, it's very, very similar to this theory by a guy called Henri Bergson, who explained this sort of notion of this kind of like productive, unconscious sort of point. Mm. And the way that I've theorized it is, I've said, no, you, in some ways, you even pop out of that. It's almost another, it's like another phase that exists, where it's like there's a sort of prep period, then there's this kind of like weird production period that you have no control over, and then really in many ways the creative writing happens after the production. Do you know what I mean? So in other words, you're ordering it, getting it right, is the thing that is the creative part of it. The other thing is just pure, like you said earlier on, like a sort of stream of consciousness, not in the Joycean or Virginia Woolf kind of context. It's like a stream of consciousness that you really have no control over. Yeah. I go and sit in a coffee shop once a week and I try and write my novel. I'm writing a comic novel at the moment. At least I think it's comic anyway. It might be comic unintentionally. But basically, you know, I sit there. I kind of know where the story's going, but I don't know what I'm going to produce. And I think in some ways that's the best way of explaining it. So the process that I've always engaged with when talking to creative people. I thought about asking you ages ago. I thought, I'll ask you actually if you can give me an interview on this, because it's basically that sort of sense of, it's almost like a sort of gay abandon. It's that notion that creative people in some ways, it's not quite being lost in the moment. It's like that sense of not knowing when the muses come and then you're off and you really just don't know. You're almost on autopilot without even knowing you're on autopilot. It's a really difficult thing to explain.
No, because I can relate. Because like the exercise I was talking to, just for the listeners' benefit, what I was talking to you about before we started recording, I try every day. I don't do it every day, but I try every day to write 3 pages of stream of conscious in response to a photograph. Out of that process, I then changed the rules one time where I stopped looking at photographs, and for 60 days straight, I just tried to write a continuous story without any idea where it was going. So I would finish 3 pages, and the following day I would go, right, what happens next? Without knowing, but the rules were always 3 pages only. I never wrote any more than that. And I did it for 60 days straight till I had a kind of shite novel. And then I turned, but I had so much background and backstory, I turned that into a screenplay. Now, I didn't start off with that process thinking I'm going to write a screenplay. It was just this dogmatic idea. And I teach at Liverpool Media Academy. I teach concepts of story development to first and second year undergraduates. And one of the things I'm constantly badgering them about is, and it's interesting you call it like an aura and all that. I just refer to it as tricking your subconscious into giving you the good stuff. Because if you're conscious of it, you'll get nothing.
It's like sort of going the other side of that, you know, suspension of disbelief in novel reading. Hmm. Of course, you know, I sort of, you know, teach all that sort of stuff as well. You know, in some ways, you know, mentioning what a realist novel is to students, I always say to them, well, look, you know, Jane Eyre goes off into the countryside and, you know, disappears into the middle of nowhere. And wow, she suddenly sort of like, you know, meets all these people she knows and knocks on a random door and it's her cousin John, you know, St. John rather. And so I say, well, you know, in real life, so to speak, it doesn't happen. And the students say, well, how can it be realism then? And I say, well, the point is a realist story is a story that in some ways is being told for a reason, right? Right? Yeah. So in other words, in this story, it did happen. And that's the weird, weird thing about it. And I think in some ways, what you're doing creatively writing is you're reversing that. Instead, you're not suspending disbelief. I had a good way of explaining this a minute ago, but I got sidetracked by Jane Eyre then. But basically, it's like, you know, that sort of notion of when you said you're sort of tricking yourself into this subconscious, in some ways, you're not tricking yourself at all. You are. It's almost meditative. But it's the thing about it is every single person I've spoken to, including the musicians, you know, obviously, who you know, plug in their guitars and play their drum kit and off they go. It's that sort of sense of like the meditation doesn't automatically happen. The writers said to me, you know, some days it does, some days it doesn't. The ceramics experts sort of said to me, it's what my hands decide to do, really. You know, it's like whether my hands are prepared to kind of like create something for me. And in some ways, it's that separation in some ways of the sort of haptic and the psychological. It's this sort of sense of like, you know, I can't really control what my hands are doing. And it's like when you're typing on your computer, it's like I can't really control what my fingers are typing. And you're not really thinking I can't control, you're just off. But it doesn't happen all the time. So when you said about looking at the photographs, I thought to myself, that's like an exercise. You know what I mean when I say I'm being rhetorical. That's like an exercise, right? I look at a photograph, I'll sort of give myself a writing exercise to try and create a sort of bit of flash fiction or something around that photograph. But the process in some ways that I talk about is not sort of doing an exercise. It's the bit that you were talking about a minute ago where you kind of say to yourself, right, I'm just going to write something and it's just going to come.
Yeah.
And you get that feeling, you know, with a lot of modernist literature that you get that feeling, even though they might not admit it. If you could go back in time and talk to some of the modernist writers, they might not admit it. But in some ways, you sense that stream of consciousness stuff that they used to write was one of those things where they sort of sit down and they just stop when they stop. You know, you can imagine it. Wasn't it Kerouac who used to stick all of the bits of typewriter, you know, the paper together, and he just have this massive scroll coming out of the back of his typewriter. Right. So he didn't have to stop and change the, you know. And I think that's kind of like Kerouac. Obviously, had a mega mezzanine. You know, he'd probably go on for hours without realizing what he typed up. Whereas, you know, I suppose the more kind of conventional amongst us probably can manage but about also an hour
I've,
of it.
The other thing I've learned in terms of creativity for myself is the power of dialogue. So not necessarily working with a collaborator, but just sharing my idea and letting somebody react to it. And then I react to the reaction and suddenly you begin to find clarity in what you're thinking. And you might even find a new way of looking at what you're trying to think about that's complete opposite. But without the dialogue, you'd never get there on your own. I know Burroughs referred to this as like the third mind, didn't he? That if two people get together, a third mind is created by the very nature that.
Or Leavis with the third realm, Or indeed, it's Roland Barthes, isn't it? Roland Barthes and Foucault, you know, that kind of like, who is an author, the death of the author. In some ways, the death of the author being, that's the thing I always love when I teach the students this. I say to them, you know, words do not belong to us, right? Okay, they're recycled. We put them in an order and then it's up to a reader to make sense of them. But you can never, ever penetrate what the author means, because you can never get inside the author's head and live their life and see what the author saw. As an exercise, for example, I give some of my students the opening paragraph of Laurie Lee's Cider with Rosie. What a cliche, but nevertheless, you know, half of them haven't read it these days, you know. And they see this, you know, I was set down at the cart at the age of three, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And then at the end of it, they've all thought, oh, that's magnificent. You know, I say to them, what do you see? And they just thought, oh, you know, sort of a field, you know, this, that, and they said, no, what can you see? You know, what is it? What can you see? And then they say to themselves, well, I don't know. I can see, like, you know, a field with a little boy. And I'd say, no. For example, what I see is Lamphy in Pembrokeshire in the 1970s when I was growing up, right? That's what I see. But there's no, Laurie Lee couldn't have seen that when he was writing those particular words. And so in some ways, the value of, like you just said, you know, is letting somebody else have a scan, a read, a think. What do they see? In some ways, that collaboration, I guess, is also part of the process. But that's not, I've got to admit, Stu, actually, you've just got me thinking. I've never interviewed a group of people about that. So that might be the next one. That might be the next paper. You know, collaboration, the death of the author and collaboration.
But the thing is that where this all started for me is I was lucky enough to interview Genesis Peorage, and he always viewed the reaction of the work by somebody else as being how he understood the work. He just made it without any true understanding of what he was doing. I don't mean that he was dumb to the process or whatever.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Whereas I've interviewed other artists who are so controlling of what the message is with the work that if you so much as say, oh, this reminds me of this in the 70s, they go, well, it's not about that. It's not about that. And you're like,
I don't know. I shouldn't really cast judgment, should I? But no, I tend to be, it's in some ways it's like that old, you know, it's the vibe. You release your words into the wild, don't you? Yeah. And whatever people do with them, they do with them. All art is like that, isn't it? I wrote a piece for the Byline Times last week and it's gone out there. It's me sort of talking about something, you know, to do with Welsh independence, right? I wish I don't believe in, by the way, unless it's linked to Europe, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so basically, you know, and my sort of view was, you know, slight sort of nervousness, anxiety about it, thinking, oh, well, people going to have a go at me because, you know, I don't believe in, like, you know, the sort of Welsh independence sort of thing. But then after a while, you just think, well, that's just their own interpretation anyway. I mean, everybody's entitled to their opinion, as the cliche goes, but it's also everybody's entitled to interpret your work the way they want to. If you release it out there, that's part of the process, absolutely, isn't it? You know, after all.
No, I mean, like, even like my little writing exercise, which sort of keeps me keen, as it were, I take the three pages, and in that moment, I go, what have I just done? What is it? Is it about this character? Is it a story about this?
Yeah.
And I'll summarize it. And often, because of the nature of doing it in the morning, the first thing, it might be just what I'm angry about. So you end up sort of projecting onto the picture what you're angry about. Yeah. And there's a couple of times where, and generally I'm a bit kind of, I can get a bit class war about it. So if there's a picture of a posh person, I'll invent a fiction that the posh person is literally killing the poor to become successful or whatever. And every now and again, I'll look at my summary of what I've done and going, oh, should I really, really? That seems a bit too cold-hearted. And then I'll show my wife and she'll be like, oh, that's interesting. And she won't bat an eyelid. And I'm thinking I've got a hand grenade in my hand and it's just four lines of text.
Yeah, I know what you mean, man. It's just back to that thing, isn't it? It's about, you know, I guess the Beatles felt anxiety on the 1st of June 1967, didn't they? When they released Sgt. Pepper, they probably thought, what are people going to make of this? What you know, will the people think we've gone crazy? It's you know, and again, it's just that a critical reaction to anything is always going to be loaded with biography, isn't it? It's you get it, you don't get it. I mean, the stuff we're talking about today, you know, my reaction to the three films that I've chosen were because, you know, you know when you got in touch with me to ask me to take part, you said three films that mean something, and I thought, well, three films that effectively changed my direction.
Yeah.
And to me, they're three really important films. None of them are contemporary. In fact, the the newest one is 30 years old.
Yeah, 1992.
You know? It's 1990. Yeah, 92. Yeah, that's right. So yeah, it's a case really of like, you know, at the end of the day, it's just, you know, perception is purely biographical in my view. I'm a strong believer in that. I think you read it through that.
I don't know if you've seen the book. There's a book called The Psychology of Screenwriting, and it's written by a psychologist about the process of writing screenplays. And I interviewed the guy, Bill Indyk, who's the psychologist who wrote the book. I think he did do screenwriting, if I remember rightly, and then carried on to become a psychologist. And one of the things he revealed to me, which I wasn't aware of, because he looks at Freud and all that on Jung and shows you how their theories exist in how we write character. It's really fascinating. I mean, it's not like it's telling you something new. It's just translating it in a different way. Whether you're a learned or an instinctive writer. But one thing he did tell me though, is that no matter what I write, like say I'm writing a 6-year-old girl having a bike ride through the Scottish Islands. I'm writing about myself. Yeah. If I'm writing about the captain of the high seas with a fleet of ships in 1725, I'm writing about myself. And I never knew this. I never knew that this is kind of what was fueling everything I do. No matter how much I try and make myself not write about myself, everything is, which made me then understand the idea of why you need diverse voices, because obviously I'm only one point of view. Mm. And no matter how diverse I might make my cast, as it were, in terms of, or the world that I might set my story in, I'm still the only author. And
you're commanding what they're saying and how they're seeing through their eyes.
And that's not that. And it's not even about unconscious bias. It was like he was saying, psychologically, you can only write about yourself. So whatever I'm doing, it's weird to think that all writing then becomes cathartic, even though you're not conscious of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I could be writing some trashy horror film, and in some way, shape, or form, this is a cathartic thing about my own psychological makeup.
It's like, you basically, there's that sort of psychiatrist couch behind you. I think you need to lie down on that for a minute.
Indeed.
I'll take some notes. Tell me about your childhood.
Exactly. You know? Well, look, before I reveal too much, let us move into three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Before we do, I will explain the rules to the listener that might come to this for the first time. Phil has given me three films. We will talk about the three films, but only for 5 minutes at a time. And at the end of 5 minutes, we will hear this sound.
Oh, God, that reminds me of being woken up in the morning.
Starting at the top, 5 minutes of counting. You've given me the first film on your list is Orlando from 1992, a Virginia Woolf adaptation written and directed by Sally Potter and starring Tilda Swinton, Billy Zane and Quentin Crisp. Where does that feature in your life story?
Magnificence. Well, that is the, and I don't want to sound all sort of like, whatever the word is, you know what I mean? Sort of like making myself sound too important, but it's the film that actually really changed my life, actually. It was a pure accident. I left school without many qualifications, and I went and did a youth training scheme and God knows what else. And I worked in the NHS for a bit, and I just enjoyed myself going to watch bands, you know, did a little bit of scouting with a friend of mine, would watch groups and stuff like that. And basically I was going absolutely nowhere. And I basically enrolled on an A-level course at a further ed college, just to test myself whether I could actually do something. A well-known musician actually said to me in an alleyway outside a small venue in Derby. I won't name him, but basically he said to me, "What are you doing with your life, man? You should be doing something else, a bit more constructive than this." And I went off and did these A-levels. Anyway, to get to the point, Orlando appeared at Green Lane Art Cinema in Derby, where I was living at the time. And I just happened to chance upon an advert for this one afternoon, sitting around at my friend's house, Steve Hardy, who's also a scriptwriter, actually. Okay. And I said to him, "Christ, this looks really interesting. Do you fancy going to this?" Thinking he'd probably say, "Oh, I can't do it tonight," or anything like that. And he said, "Yeah, let's do it." So we drove down there and watched it. And I've got to admit, it blew my mind. It blew my mind on many levels. And the meaning of it continues to reveal itself to me over time, 30 years since I first saw it.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For it, I mean, for me, it was a case of the film itself, you know, which was about, you know, all the stuff that Virginia Woolf was talking about, the longest love letter ever, you know, Vita Sackville West, etc., gender fluidity and all that, the mores, the values, the laws of its ages and so forth. So as a sociologist, it's interesting too. But also as a literary person, which I have been sort of undercover for many years, it sort of set me fair on my way to university, ultimately to Cambridge, you know, which is where I ended up. And it was one of those things that really, really influenced me to sort of buckle down, take literature seriously, work hard, get into this and get excited by it. So my interest, weirdly, in English literature was kicked off by Virginia Woolf. That's why, you know, I've got, you know, a big library at home and a big bit of it is it involves Virginia Woolf and stuff
but
about
her. Also interestingly there is through a film. Why did a film, how did the film manage to tap into that desire?
Well, it's weird because I'd never read the novel. That was okay. The thing. I hadn't read the novel at that point in time. I knew who Virginia Woolf was, but yeah. Orlando was not quite obscure, but it was obscure to a 22-year-old.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, we'd all heard of To the Lighthouse. And I remember my tutor saying to me at the time, well, they go to the lighthouse. You know, that's a Virginia Woolf novel for you. It's not even my favorite Virginia Woolf novel. That's Mrs. Dalloway, right? But this one, I mean, there's scenes in it. The scene that always comes out of me, two scenes.
Okay.
One is where the Archduke, well, Orlando has said earlier on to Sasha, the Russian princess, you know, you marry me because I am England and you are mine. And then later, after Orlando's transmogrified into a woman, the Archduke is offering to marry her so she can save her house. And she's getting, what's this about? You know, and he says, because I'm England and you are mine. And she just freaks out and goes into the maze. Right? She's had a massive set to in a salon with Addison and Alexander Pope and Swift, right? And basically she's really uptight and she goes into this maze. And that scene, the maze, has got to be my favorite all-time film scene. It's Sally Potter. It's a transitional scene. But it is magnificent. Anybody listening to this, go and watch that scene. You'll find it on YouTube somewhere. The maze, right, from Orlando. And what she does is she comes out the other end. She comes out into that sort of like Austen, Bronte sort of era, you know, sort of late Regency, early Victoriana. And she runs off across the moors. And so what Potter is doing is mixing the moors with, you know, sort of Devon, et cetera. So you're getting a bit of sense and sensibility in there and this, that, and the next thing. Shelmerdine appears on a horse and it's Willoughby riding up to Marianne after Marianne has broken her ankle. But on this occasion, Shelmerdine is the person who's injured and Orlando is the person asking if he's okay, you know, and it's like he falls off his horse. It's one of those great scenes. It really seriously moves me. And I show it to my students every year in my cultural studies module, you know, and they think the same thing, I think, you know. So it's a great film. I love it. I love it.
Well, there's the first 5 minutes.
There you go, Sue. I could have gone on for another 15. But
did that feel okay for 5 minutes? Did it race? Oh,
yeah. No. There were so many things I wanted to say about it. It was either that or it was Polanski's Tess, because Tess also turned me on to Hardy. But that was earlier. You know, that was 89. I first saw that. Yeah. So it was it was really, really important, that film. And I still watch it. I still watch it over and over again. It's one of those weird. And I don't normally do that with films. My eldest son is an absolute film buff, right?
Yeah.
He's so into his movies. And, you know, as far as, you know, to him, you know, he's 14 and he's saying, right, I'm going to do English literature, then film studies as an MA, right? I'm thinking, whoa, steady on, man. But it's like, he's totally into this idea. And he watches films a lot. But with me, he always berates me. Oh, you never watch any films, you know, this, that. But it has to be a good, good film that means something to me. And so that's one of that. That is probably the film.
Okay. Well, segueing in beautifully then. So your second choice is Gregory's Girl from 1980, the great Bill Forsyth, starring John Sinclair, the largely unknown now Dee Hepburn, I guess, and Claire Grogan. What do you, where does Gregory Girls fit in the pantheon of film miles?
Well, the weird thing is we're sort of going backwards and then we come forwards again with the third one. But basically the reason why I thought Gregory's Girl, I did sit and think, there's a whole host of those Forsyth films I thought were fantastic anyway. And I quite like, you know, I also thought, you know, Trainspotting, I don't know, something like that. I don't know. Films that I could, with Shallow Grave, you know, I don't know, you know, something like that. Cause I love those. But I think with Gregory's Girl, it sounds like it's sort of almost from the sublime to the ridiculous, from Orlando to Gregory's Girl. But there's something about it. I don't know. It's the ultimate, in my view, and I guess this is what it's all about. It's the ultimate sort of uncertain teenager movie. Mm. And to me, it's a rite of passage film that has a genuine level of sort of, it's funny, but it also has that sort of, it's sort of quite touching in places. It's very, and it also speaks to a teenager, right? It's, I remember basically myself and my friends, when we were about 14, we were all into music, this, that, and the next thing. And we had two films that we used to watch on VHS, over and over and over and over again. Yeah, classic sort of vibe, you know, where you'd be, you know, sitting around in an afternoon and you put a video on. One of them, believe it or not, was Bless This House, the Bless This House film, which I still love.
Seriously? Right?
I absolutely love that film. I can't explain why. I love it. Who cares? I think it's a great laugh, that film, especially the psychedelic Morris Minor. But basically, Gregory's Girl was the other one. And I think in some ways with Bless This House, it was just a good old laugh. But basically with Gregory's Girl, it spoke to this bunch of 14-year-old boys watching it.
Yeah.
Because in some ways you identify with it. You identify with, in some ways, Gregory was both us and doing it for us as well. Do you know what I mean? It Absolutely. Was that sort of notion where you wanted him to succeed in it, right? But you also had an intrinsic knowledge in some ways in your 14-year-old teenage mind, where you thought Dorothy's not the right one, right? It's not the right one. It's got to be something else. I remember the first time I saw it, I remember thinking, I don't think he's going to get the girl, right? And it turns out, of course, Gregory's Girl is fabulous. I mean, Claire Grogan, in her own way, I mean, Claire Grogan's fabulous anyway, but Claire Grogan, in her own way, was the embodiment of a fab girlfriend that you would like.
Exactly.
Right? And so, yeah, in some ways, he showed it was possible to get the girl, didn't he? The right girl, right? If you're patient and you're a bit lucky and you've got a lot of good friends, you'll get the right girl. And also, it also sort of had that balance as well between home and school and friends, you know, the universe of the in-betweeners, if you like. And also some of the jokes that run through it as well, which I'm sure a lot of listeners will remember. I'm sure you'll remember, Stu. You know, things like, you know, the high jumper who just appears randomly throughout it, just jumping straight into the bar constantly. And you got like the food sales in the toilets, which is really funny. The borrowing of the jacket, you know, we all
if I think of what I remember most about it, it's the fact that it is about the cruelty of being a young person and not knowing, but there isn't a cruel bone in the film, if that makes sense.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of the best scenes, the scene that I love most of all is where his father, who's a driving instructor, only appears very briefly in the film, which is supposed to be like that because he never sees his dad. And his dad's sort of like giving a driving lesson, encouraging this bloke to try and run Gregory over. And I remember thinking at the time when I first saw it, I thought it was one of the funniest scenes I've ever seen in a film. It's brilliant. It's like, obviously, he sort of winds the window down and they're strangers to one another despite living in the same house. And I just think that's one of those brilliant sort of things, you know, the distance between father and son at that age. And, you know, the lack of communication is given this brilliant comic turn. So I think it's really well scripted. A lot of it was improvised. It used, like a lot of those films like Quadrophenia, etc., used a lot of young actors who'd been through sort of youth theatre groups who were brilliant actors and could just do it, could do the kids. You know, they could just be kids because they were kids. And so it gave it that authenticity that's really important. I think it's a great film. And Caracas, of course, you know, is where all of us kind of like thought we'd like to end up, but we all kind of knew in the end that in their instance, Cumbernauld, and in our instance, wherever we were living was kind of like the boundaries of our reality. And that, you know, there was never a kind of pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. I mean, there was only Claire Grogan, you know.
It's interesting you mentioned the word authenticity, because I think that's often the thing that he certainly missed. Oh, there's the time. I'll finish my thought just for the sake as I stand. I was just thinking that it's often the thing that gets, certainly when you get brought up on largely American teen dramas, where the authenticity is hard to see because you don't live in a small suburban town in Midwest America or on the outskirts of New York City or wherever the film might, or, you know, Santa Monica. I mean, these are just fantasy islands. And the idea of a grey, cold sky against backdrops of terraced housing and high-rise flats and windy fields where it doesn't look inviting, but everyone's still playing sports, was genuinely authentic. And it's kind of like, it reinforces an importance that I think that sadly, I think the dominance of US entertainment, you kind of lose somewhere in the mix, because if all you're fed on is this kind of Hollywood version of what Jungian.
That's right, man. Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah, you're right. The authenticity in it, again, like you say, in terms of their school looked like my school, you know. Yeah. So, well, you know, admittedly, we had more of a playing field than they did, but it was a case of like, you know, rather play football on grass than sort of gravel or whatever it was. But yeah, you're quite right. I've got to agree with that. I think it's a feel good movie. And funnily enough, just very, very quickly, because I know we're kind of breaking the rules here, but I showed it to, I was in a band years ago, and I showed it to the drummer of the band and his wife, who he hadn't long been married to. And they came over to our place one evening and we were sitting having a couple of drinks, what, you know, 10, 15 years ago. I said, "You've never seen Gregory's Girl?" No, we'd never seen it. So I put it on. I thought to myself, this is a hit and miss moment. You know, they're either going to love this or they're going to think it's like the longest 90 minutes in their adult lives. And sure enough, it didn't miss the spot. You know, they got it. And even his wife, who's South African as well, even she got it as well. I think it's universal. I think it's a universal thing. I think it might have been set in Cumbernauld, but it could have been anywhere. You know, it's. I think it's the same for young people everywhere.
So for your third choice, and knowing you like I do, I can imagine how this might have had an impact on your young life. We're going to talk about 1968 Monterey Pop, D.A. Pembaker's even, film about the greatest pre-Woodstock rock music festival. Where does that feature in the life of Dr. Philip Miles?
Well, that was
and when did you see it, by the way? When did you see Monterey Pop for the first time?
I saw it would have been probably 86.
Okay.
85. Actually, probably 85. Channel 4 put it on.
Okay.
And basically, I tell you the story behind this, right? Okay, I had one of those moments in 1985. I can even remember the dates, right? August the 5th, 1985.
Right.
Right. I went into Derby City Centre, where I was living at the time, with my parents, and I bought Revolver by the Beatles. Wow. And it was the first Beatles album that I bought. It was basically, I had the blue album as a hand-me-down, you know, the blue double.
Yeah.
67 to 70. And I'd read, you know, Suggs and Paul Weller and God knows loads of other people around that time had been saying, you know, Revolver, you know, among other things, you know, was one of the key albums of, you know, their kind of youth and their sort of musical transition. So I went and bought it and I was blown away. And my Beatles obsession began there. Now, what actually happened was then, as a result of that, I had one of those mid-teen transitions music-wise,
yeah,
where I became totally turned on by freakout music, by, you know, kind of like, you know, that classic sort of psychedelia, dope and acid, hippie, San Francisco, everything you can throw at, right, okay, I became suddenly obsessed with, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, the Jefferson Airplane, you name it, right? Mm. And basically, I always call him Pennebaker. It's not, Pennebaker, yeah. Monterey Pop came on Channel 4 and I taped it, videoed it. And I watched it over and over and over and over again. My adoration of the Jefferson Airplane came from that film. The opening sequence of it, you know, using Scott McKenzie's San Francisco, all that kind of incidental sort of clips of, you know, sort of proper 1967 hippies during the sort of acid flower power era. Brian Jones appears momentarily in it. You know, it starts off with this girl saying, have you ever been to a love-in? You know, and just, you know, it had that sort of feeling of renaissance, right? And it was something that, you know, it was a film that I just watched over and over again. You know, you got The Who on there. So The Who were the transition band, right? I loved The Who prior to 1985, yeah? You got the Jefferson Airplane, who were my new obsession at the time, along with the Beatles, right? Okay, Jimi Hendrix, who I never became a massive Hendrix fan, but Hendrix is, you know, set at Monterey that we could only see then. Now, due to the internet, we can see pretty much all of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, that was pretty special. But the other thing that blew my mind as well was Ravi Shankar. And I show my students Ravi Shankar's clip, you know. Well, I mean, I don't show the whole clip because it's like, you know, about 12 minutes long. But the sort of the climax of the festival, Ravi Shankar playing. And there's this fantastic moment where you see that he's, you know, him and I think it's Ali Raka are playing this sort of like, you know, sitar, sarod, I don't know, you know, tablas and all that sort of going. And basically it goes to this massive climax, this piece of Indian music, right? And you see for briefly the front row of, you know, it was like, you know, they were all sitting down, you know, on seats in this Monterey sort of sports complex stadium thing that they were using right by the airport there. And you can see Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees, right? Go and check this out. You can see him and he's just going, oh my God, you know, they are all in raptures at this music that Ravi Shankar's playing. No doubt. I mean, who wouldn't be when they listen to it? It's the most amazing climax to it. So it was excitement. I became a goth, you know, pretty much, you know, within 12 months from seeing it. But nevertheless, I mean, goth just became the next sort of phase on from being a hippie, really. But I went to Glastonbury in 1987 in the hope that it would be something like it. And I guess it probably was a little bit like it. Missed New Order because I can't remember New Order, though I was there. But basically, it's a long story. You don't want to know. It involves homebrew. It's not good, right? But basically, you know, I have seen New Order, but I can't remember seeing them. But basically, yeah, it was a pivotal piece of film, and I just loved it. I still do love it, and I still watch clips of it, and I still show my students in my cultural studies unit clips from it to show them what 1967 and the kind of the acid rock scene was about, and how Britain, you know, about the, you know, the 12 hour Technicolor Dream and, you know, Monterey and all those things that were going on. The precursors, of course, of all the stuff that eventually ended up arguably in Woodstock, but more despondently at Altamont at the end of 1969.
I was going to say, you're watching this in the mid 80s sort of amidst the fact that you can watch the celebration in isolation, and I guess in pre-internet, you're not thinking about Altamont at all. Whereas the lineage of the whole popular culture thing was basically the hippie dream ended in 69 at Altamont. Whereas, you're omitting that from your own personal youth development, because what you're seeing is the music that played at Monterey, as an artifact. Yeah. Now you're not seeing it as a living, breathing momentum of the kind of, you know, because I guess, you know, we before 1960, I mean, what the hell were teenagers? I mean, they just were about emerging as a force of their own. And like the idea that we'd take young people seriously was a nonsense. And then
absolutely.
And then by Altamont, it was like, no, we shouldn't take young people seriously because they'll just lose their mind, said the Conservatives. And it took one horrible thing to ruin it all.
That's right, man. It's like the thing that I always love showing the students from that era is Grace Slick on the Smothers Brothers doing White Rabbit. In my view, it's the moment you can capture counterculture or subculture, really counterculture, I'd prefer to call it. Because like she's singing about, you know, the White Rabbit and the straights watching the Smothers Brothers, millions of them on a Sunday evening, watching the Jefferson Airplane do this weird sort of like colourful, you know, sort of like all the kind of, you know, the oil sort of slides playing in the background, and Yorma Kekkonen playing, you know, sort of playing his guitar with Ed Band on, and Jack Cassidy with his long hair playing the bass. And Grace Slick standing on the top of this, I think if I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure she's standing on the top of the piano. And the thing that gets me about it, it's a perfect moment because she's singing this song, the lyrics to White Rabbit, straight into the camera. She's looking straight into the camera. So she is looking straight into the living rooms or lounges, whatever you want to call it, of middle America on a Sunday evening, right? In 1967. And she's singing to all the straights and the parents. She's singing about Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, right? To all of the turned on kids, she's talking about something very, very different indeed. And basically the clues are in the lyrics, you know, the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. But it's the crescendo. It's the massive sort of like crescendo of the song, Feed Your Head, is probably the moment, I think, where basically it was almost peak sort of counterculture, that was. Because I don't think, you know, anybody had ever got into the lounges, the living rooms. Of all of the straights. Vietnam was raging in the background and all this sort of stuff. And she was sort of saying effectively, you know what I mean, but they don't know what I mean, you know? And I love it. I think it's a great moment.
Out of interest, how do you think, for you as a young Brit, this 1967, 68 music was able to cut through post-punk Britain, you know, like... Yeah.
Well, it was the thing. I mean, just like everybody else. I mean, the weird thing with me with punk rock was I got into Peel and punk rock when I was about 13, 14.
Yeah.
I went off it and came back into it when I was a goth, if you know what I mean. So post-punk gothic music, you know, Bauhaus and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Did come when I was 17. I didn't get that sort of stuff. Even Joy Division came when I was 17. I hadn't engaged with them properly. I was probably just engaging with what you would call traditional British 1976-7 punk music. In fact, to me, my favourite punk band, controversially, were The Jam, if you know what I mean. The Jam's first album, In the City, to me, was like, you know, a power pop punk record.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think it gets celebrated enough as that, actually. But the hippie thing, I think, was just, for me, it was a case of like, you know, I'd understood the 60s. I'd understood the sort of mod stuff. I'd understood everything like that. And for me, it was, we were listening, myself and a couple of friends, we grew our hair a bit. We were wearing headbands and flares before the Stone Roses got into them, right? Okay, it's a few years before the Stone Roses started doing this. Basically, you know, in terms of flares, that is. Mm. Basically, we were listening to Gong a lot, you know, early Gong, not the daft stuff that came later, you know, those first four or five Gong records, bit of early Hawkwind. Didn't matter. Johnny Rotten can't say you can't listen to Hawkwind, right? Okay, because he's already, he was on record even then as being a big Hawkwind fan himself. So, you know, we were listening to, you know, early Hawkwind, you know, pre-Lemmy era even, Gong, all that sort of stuff. But also this kind of, this not just the Beatles. The Beatles were representative of British counterculture. We were listening to all this sort of like West Coast American stuff. It still takes pride of place in my record collection. I've got practically a full set of Airplane albums. You know, you name it, everything, you know, like I mentioned earlier, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young, you know, the Birds, you know, on and on it goes. But for me, I'm not joking. If I could get in a time machine, that would be the place I'd go. Monterey, Southern California, 1967. And then I'd just get in a bus and head up to Haight Ashbury straight after it. I know it all went wrong within a few months, but, you know, to be able to go and witness that scene, I'd witnessed that over Woodstock. I'd witnessed that over a lot of things, you know. And it's for me, that was the that was a seriously important moment. I mean, I knew Don't Look Back. I'd seen that, you know, the Dylan one.
Yeah.
I'd seen that prior to Monterey. But, oh, wow. Pennebaker as did one on the sort of hippie scene in San Francisco. Of course, it's not Frisco. It's south of LA. No, it's in between LA and San Francisco, isn't it, Monterey? But basically, for me, you know, what you see at the start of the Woodstock film, you know, with Long Time Gone playing over, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Long Time Gone playing. Great bit of music that is as well. To me, is like, you know, Monterey, you know, transposed over 24 months later. What you see at Monterey, I mean, that's the reason Brian Jones is there, you know, who's another hero of mine, you know, who's from the town I live in, actually, these days. He, you know, he's sort of, I remember me and my mate watching this going, is that Brian Jones from the Stones there? And it's obviously, it's only sort of later on that you realise that, yeah, he'd sort of dropped into California for that, and hardly surprising what Brian Jones was like at the time. But, you know, it was...
Well, look, going back over your three films, it's interesting that the first two was like, well, the first one was like you and your mate go make a basic decision to go watch a film, and then together you share this thing that becomes life-changing for you. Then you've got you and your mates with one of two films on VHS that you watch together. And then it's interesting that your last choice is something you caught on Channel 4 and it became your own little indoctrination into, and I don't mean that pejoratively, but into something that you weren't aware of. And that opened its own door. I think it really speaks to the, I mean, because they're so different, all three of your choices. It's interesting how they could have the effect on one single person, but then that's kind of the joy of it all, isn't it?
That's it, yeah. No, nobody understood us either. It was weird. There was like two or three of us who got into this, and we were just in suburban Derby, and everybody else had, you know, kind of like, we're listening to, you know, U2 and Simple Minds and stuff, and, you know, we're, you know, all the people we knew at school and stuff were into all this straight music and stuff, which wasn't bad. It it wasn't my scene. I was listening to other stuff. But they thought we were crazies. You know, they thought we'd kind of lost the plot completely. Why's Phil got this little mushroom thing, you know, sort of stitched to his flared jeans? What's happened to him? What's gone wrong there, man? Why is he talking about Bob Dylan, the Beatles and the Jefferson Airplane all the time? But, you know, 2 years later, we were completely sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm trying to think of the word now.
Vindicated.
You know, no, but I mean, you know, the Stone Roses started.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
You know, playing this sort of stuff, and then Supergrass are playing Neil Young covers, and you know, excuse the language. I don't know if that's allowed, but you know, Oasis are banging on about their influences. And I'm sort of thinking maybe I should have stuck at my guitar practice, because, you know, I was thinking, I saw Supergrass I can't remember what year it was. I've seen them quite a few times. I can't try to remember which gig it was. But they played a cover of Cinnamon Girl by Neil Young. Neil Young's Decade album was A Hand Me Down. And that was the same era that I was listening to it. And Cinnamon Girl was just one of those tracks that we just had on constant repeat, you know, on the record player, literally that side of that album. The needle would come off and go back on again, right? And I was thinking to myself, well, they were obviously listening to the stuff at the same time. You know, they were getting into this. Where were they? You know, we had no way of making contact with one another. But obviously there were these turned on kids who were listening to all this 60s.
Well, God, do you know what? And I'm going to sound like an old man shouting at the sky. But in a way, thank goodness, not for the internet didn't exist then, because it would have connected people who were busy just sort of mining their own furrows and stuff. And I think that's where...
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah,
I think it's where the interesting stuff comes. I mean, not to say there isn't interesting stuff now, because it's obviously not for me. I'm not the youth anymore. But I think that joy of something just mushrooming out of seemingly nothing because a couple of people have decided to pay attention to something specific that is just out of time and out of touch is always the fun part of it all. Well, look, sir, we've reached the end of the podcast. Remind us, what's the name of the book you did about the midlife? What was it?
It's called Midlife Creativity and Identity. Okay. It's got a life into art. Midlife Creativity and Identity. It's called. It's It's in paperback. Actually, it's on Amazon and stuff, the usual things.
Yeah, no, I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, nice one, man.
It's a fascinating subject, and
it's very sociological, though, right? What I will say, by all means, please, anybody who's interested, please do read it. It's great. It's got ethnography in it. It's got interviews with people who create stuff, and it's entertaining in its own way. But it is a sociological tract.
Right? No, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, look, it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving your time on the BritFlix podcast.
Yeah, thanks very much, Stu. Thanks for inviting me. It's good to see you again, hear you again. And it's been a gas.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.